PD Pods present the PD Podscast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the PD Podscast, hosted by myself, Pranay Budev. We sit down with leaders and legends from the field of pediatric orthopedics from all around the globe. And it is my honour to present to you this next episode where we sit with Professor Michael Millis of Boston Children's Hospital. This recording was done prior to the COVID pandemic earlier this year at the Burn Hip Symposium, where he was the guest of honour for his contribution to hip preservation. He's a graduate of the Harvard Medical School and also served in the US Navy prior to his faculty position at Boston Children's Hospital. He had an AO fellowship where he spent time with Professor Heinz Wagner in Germany, where he then decided to pursue a career-long interest in developmental hip conditions and their evolution through adolescence and adulthood. He was subsequently the founding director of the Adolescent and Young Adult Hip Unit at Boston Children's Hospital and is a professor of orthopedic surgery at Harvard Medical School. In this episode, we discuss his career, how he navigated his research and educational interests, and what he describes as hipology and hapology. I truly hope you enjoy it. Please comment, like, and subscribe to the podcast on all major podcast platforms and follow us on Twitter at PDPods. And I look forward to seeing you on our next episode released the first and third Sunday of every month. Let's get into it. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the PD Podcast with me, Pranay Budev. I am absolutely privileged and honoured to be sitting with Professor Michael Millis from Harvard and Boston Children's Hospital here today. We're currently at the Burn Hip Symposium, where he's been honoured with being the guest of honour here, and he gave a fantastic speech on this today. And Dr. Millis, I have to say, tell you that it was actually after spending time with you last year in Boston, that was one of the main reasons that inspired me to do the podcast, because I got to spend time with people like you and with Dr. Perry Schenecker, and became really curious as to your career and how you've made it to be so successful. So thank you for sitting with me to talk about your career.
It's a pleasure, Pranay. It's a pleasure to be here and to share my thoughts with you. That's been a lot of my career, sharing thoughts and continuing to learn.
You truly have orthopedic blood running through your veins. I believe your father was an orthopedic surgeon. Is that correct?
That is true.
And so tell me a bit about your upbringing and who you were exposed to in your early childhood and what led you towards a career in orthopedics.
Certainly. Well, my first memory in life is of Iowa City, where my father was privileged to be with that Steindler machine, I guess you could call it, that wonderful orthopedic institution for a couple of years before he went off to Ohio, where he finished his orthopedic training. And indeed, he was an orthopedic surgeon, a general orthopedic surgeon with a special interest in children's orthopedics and in cerebral palsy, as a matter of fact. And I grew up exposed to that, not necessarily programmed from the onset, as far as I knew, to be an orthopedic surgeon. My interest waxed and waned, and as a matter of fact, at university, I was certain I would be a diplomat. And I did end up at Harvard. I'm the first in my family to have ventured out of the Midwest to the East Coast of the U.S. There, things evolved, and I ended up in medical school, and in the end, did finish in orthopedics.
Was there any particular person that drove you towards orthopedics? I mean, I do know that your father was very good friends with Dr. Ponsetti, is that correct?
Yes.
And who did you have any mentors during medical school or residency that sort of pushed you towards not only orthopedics, but a career in pediatric orthopedics?
The truth is, in medical school, I think it was my father. It was the example of my father, and as I actually went through university, I became more aware, as I became a young adult, how important orthopedic surgery had been to him, and the significance of that slowly dawned on me, and I drifted toward medical school, and then in medical school on to orthopedic surgery.
And what was residency like back then at Harvard?
It was a bit different, of course, than now. We had an obligatory 2 years of general surgery before orthopedics, and I would say 75 to 80% sure. As I began my general surgery, which was not in Boston, it was in Cleveland at the Case Western Reserve Institution, that I would do orthopedics. But I became exposed to some wonderful orthopedists and pediatric orthopedists in Cleveland, and that confirmed my impression that I should do orthopedics. Then when I got to the residency at Harvard, it was Professor John Hall who I was exposed to very early in my orthopedic training, and he convinced me that pediatric orthopedics was the way to go for me.
What was it specifically about Professor Hall's sort of influence on you that made you lead? There's normally something very particular about someone that drives people towards a specialty.
I don't know who else perhaps you've been exposed to that knew Professor Hall or had been trained by him, but he was a man with charisma beyond belief. And this is not just personal beauty, but he was a really straightforward, honest man who had tremendous abilities, didn't showcase them directly, but just stood for what I felt were all the right things in life and in orthopedics. So he was an excellent surgeon, had a profound interest in patients and their problems, and was very straightforward and demanding in the best possible way of excellence.
You served as a lieutenant commander in the Navy Medical Corps, is that
yes,
correct?
Yes.
And how, tell me about that experience, because we don't have many people these days who are surgeons that come back and do what you do following that.
No, we don't. And in that time, there was, for all males, a service commitment that I would say almost all did in the military. Some had an alternative path to do research, but for me it ended up a military obligation that fortunately I could do in orthopedics, and I could do at a high volume, relatively sophisticated military medical center in South Carolina. I was also privileged to do it after my orthopedic training, so I could take advantage and get a lot of experience and a bit of maturity before I went back into civilian practice.
Now, you were the founder of the sort of young adult hip unit or adolescent hip unit at Boston Children's, and that is really because you brought across practice that you learned in Europe, if that's correct. So you had an AO fellowship and you came across to Germany. Please tell me about your time with Professor Wagner here and what you learned and how you then translated what you learned and brought it across.
Certainly. It was my good luck to be exposed to Heinz Wagner, who in his first of many visits to the U.S. in 1974 gave a grand rounds presentation at Harvard at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. I remember the day distinctly. And he gave us insight into his great experience with complex hip osteotomies, knee osteotomies, limb lengthening, a lot of exotic at that time treatments for hip dysplasia that were really unknown in the U.S. And Professor Hall, who I was sitting behind in the amphitheater, leaned back to me and said, "Someone has to learn that those techniques because we need them." And I happened to be the right person at the right time. I was very lucky because it took 5 years, but I managed after my military training and completing the Harvard residency program to be supported by Professor Hall in an AO fellowship to go to Germany. And the AO fellowships were well known in the U.S. by that time, but mostly for trauma surgery. And they did have this small niche experience that you could get if you tried hard to get it, not just in Switzerland, but in Germany, and not just in fracture surgery, but in other related fields like hip osteotomies. And so I was fortunate to get that experience. And for me, the rest was history, because those connections and those techniques, those philosophies, literally lit a fire in me, and I hope it has not yet gone out.
No, it certainly hasn't. And I know that yesterday in your presentation, you talked a few of what you call your Wagnerisms, of things that he would say to you. Can you mention them to some of the audience and what you've learned from him?
Exactly. Well, you can never know everything about a man just by a few quotes, but you can often get a sense of the person. And he was a profoundly intelligent and thoughtful man, and complex. And for those who didn't know him well, he might have seemed a very dark personality, but he certainly was insightful. And he, you know, said things that were true, but often not easily acceptable to all. One of his statements that he often used was that the average surgeon is an average surgeon. Well, this is not really acceptable to the average surgeon. We all consider ourselves a bit above the mean, but this is true. Another quote of his that is often misunderstood was that sophisticated operations are for sophisticated patients. And some took this to mean that he only operated on the elite, but this wasn't true at all. He felt that if a complex operation had to be done, though, it required the cooperation and the understanding of the patient. And of course, every patient brings different degrees of sophistication and intelligence to the table. But he was most interested in making sure that the patients understood and could cooperate at least, and hopefully help at best to make things a success. So those are two of the things that come off the top of my head that were Heinz Wagner to me.
And one of the ones you also mentioned yesterday was a failure to plan is a plan to fail. And I think that's something that is commonly said now without me knowing, actually, that was from maybe from Professor Wagner. But that's something that I've heard quite a lot.
Yes, absolutely. Unknown to many is that he was offered the position to be head of research in Davos as a very young German surgeon. And this was really a terrific honor that he turned down in the end. But for a German to be offered a position in the heart of Switzerland by the AO was a real honor, a recognition of his terrific potential.
Now, following returning from Europe, I know you went and visited him a few times after that anyway. How did your career and job start at Boston Children's Hospital?
I was, again, very lucky many times in my life. And for whatever reason, John Hall thought that I deserved an opportunity to remain on his staff. And so after my military service, I had a young attending position offered to me at Children's Hospital, and I took it in a heartbeat. And here I am still there. It's frighteningly 42 years after that day in 1978 when I began my staff position. So at first, we were all orthopedic generalists, and that was one of the things that attracted me to Professor Hall. He was so good at so many things. He was trained well, had extra postgraduate training in thoracic surgery. So he was familiar all over the chest cavity, the front and the back of the spine, and he was known for anterior approaches to the spine. We were all trained to do these things. We were trained as well in some of these musculoskeletal approaches as the general surgeons were, who helped with the approaches in many other institutions. But we did our own thoracolumbar approaches to the spine. So this was my beginning in orthopedics. We operated on the feet, we operated on the shoulder, we operated on the neck. We were literally all over the place, and it was a thrilling time. Now, in 2020, this simply is not done most places. And we went on into subspecialization, and I think it was really about 2001, when Daniel Hedequist, one of our now outstanding spine surgeons and the head of our spine surgery section, came to Boston Children's after his fellowship, and he really needed work. There were six or seven of us on the staff doing a lot of spine surgery at that time because of Professor Hall's influence. And so Professor Kasser and I, we gave up our spine practice because Dan Hedequist really needed the business, as it were. And we gave it to him, and Kasser went on to do a lot of lower extremity things, and I went on to do hips, and I think the world's been the better for those decisions.
Now, your department at Boston Children's is very well recognized with its sort of adolescent and young adult hip unit, but you are in a children's hospital. So why do you think it's important, and who was the driving force behind actually, or had the insight to attach the sort of adolescent and young adult hip unit at Boston Children's?
Well, as in all matters in life, I suppose the answer is not a really simple one. It wasn't just one person. I think at our hospital there had been an interest in cardiac surgery initially by Robert Gross, who was an excellent, he was one of the first open heart surgeons, a very gifted surgeon in children, and he carried on operating on adults who had congenital heart problems in adulthood. So there was this tradition in the hospital for 50 or 60 years when I first got there that you could easily, in our hospital, take care of children's problems, as it were, in adults. And Professor Hall also did this. In Toronto, he worked with Salter a lot. They did many osteotomies around the hip and pelvis, not just in children, but in adults who could easily benefit from their profound skills. And so there was this background, first in Dr. Salter in Toronto, and then in Salter's colleague Hall, who came to be my mentor in Boston. And at the hospital itself, we had this tradition from Robert Gross, the cardiac surgeon. So it was an easy sell to the hospital that it could be our mission to care for more or less children of all ages. And so this was some of the background. Professor Hall did spine surgery and hip surgery on children and young adults. And so it was easy to become interested in developmental hip problems as they played out over a lifetime. And so this was my opportunity because the adult hospitals in the U.S. didn't often care for children at that stage. Many of the children's hospitals didn't care for adults. But we were lucky our hospital had the insight to allow us to at least look after to some degree into adulthood of these patients with developmental problems.
Yeah, and thankfully that's something that's now spread to multiple units, not only across North America, but also Europe. I really do feel that has helped the management of these young adults in almost the prime of their working and social life, especially when their hip pathology has really been the sequelae of pediatric hip disease.
I think it's also helped us to understand the ramifications of what we do in the children. And for example, the pre-adolescent with Perthes disease, who has little in the way of overt symptoms, but obvious, significant deformity, it has led us to be proactive in those patients.
Now, as a true godfather, you introduced the periacetabular osteotomy at Boston and trained multiple generations of surgeons with this, and this was through an abductor sparing approach. Was this something you learned elsewhere, or was this a modification of the dial osteotomy that you learned from Professor Wagner?
Again, I'd like to give you a straightforward, simple answer, Pranay, because we have our constraints of time. The truth is, yes, I learned the so-called dial osteotomy in Germany, and this was one of my major feats. It was a technically imposing operation. Not very user-friendly for the surgeon or the patient as originally designed, but a brilliant operation. Very similar to what was developed independently in Japan. I knew nothing of that, nor did Wagner initially. So I came back bringing that technique. Professor Hall encouraged me, so I had a rather large early experience. This was in the 1980s with that. I became aware through my connections with Europe that Professor Gantz was doing an operation with somewhat similar indications, advantages and disadvantages compared to the dial osteotomy. So as we, Bob Poss and Steve Murphy and I, came to develop this hip osteotomy course at Harvard, I became good friends with and was mentored by not just Wagner, as I had been at first, but also Professor Gans. Then I picked up the technique of PAO. The original PAO technique, to make a long story short, involved the full Smith-Peterson approach. The chisels didn't demand it. The Japanese chisels, the Wagner chisels were huge and demanded a very large approach. The Gans chisels were quite small, but still, this operation was done through a large Smith-Peterson exposure, which dissected the abductors extensively and in many patients led to a limp and a long rehabilitation. My insight was that my American patients did relatively poorly. They wouldn't do the physiotherapy and the prolonged rehabilitation required. Many of them limped. A couple ripped their abductors off the iliac crest after I'd repaired them. And so I said, I'm probably not as good a surgeon as Professor Gans, so I need some help. Maybe a modification of the exposure will help this problem I have. So it was Steve Murphy's and my insights that there was a problem that initially Professor Gans didn't have that led us to develop the abductor-sparing approach. But it wasn't a user-friendly approach initially to the surgeon because it demanded a lot more knowledge of the anatomy than perhaps you could get away with doing the full exposure. So that's the story of the development of the abductor-sparing approach. We did some Cybex testing that proved to us that the abductors worked much better after this approach. And the rest is history. Professor Gans, in the end, started to use the abductor-sparing approach, and I don't think anybody has very much gone back. So that, to me, told me that we'd had a good idea, and as many things in life occur, we were lucky, we thought of it, the right thing at the right time, and it's worked out very well.
Yeah, an amazing modification that's made a huge difference to the recovery of these patients. And you mentioned there sort of the involvement of physiotherapists for following up your patients. And you kindly showed me around Boston Children's last year where you have a huge multidisciplinary team, including a lot of physiatrists, which is something we don't have a huge number of in the UK. So can you tell me about physiatrists and what they do and the sort of non-operative management of your hip patients?
Prana, you know how fortunate I've been to be taught by many and benefit from the perspectives of others who are looking at the world from a very different point of view. And these include non-operative experts involved in the musculoskeletal system in general and the hip in particular. These include brilliant radiologists. These include brilliant clinical physicians who are not surgeons. Because if you don't do surgery, you have a very different perspective on the problems and what the potential solutions could be. It may or may not be somebody who is blind, who has hypertrophied other skills to help them in a world that they cannot interpret through sight. But the physiatrists really, our group who have mostly come to this through the sports medicine discipline, who are not surgeons, are brilliant in their assessments of the patients. You know, they listen, they tend to listen a little more at length. They tend to examine the patients physically a little more at length. And in our particular situation, they've used ultrasound in a way that we as orthopedists had used for the babies, but not too much advantage beyond. So in our core team of eight, three of them are non-surgeons, and they help us immensely and continue to learn more about patients with hip problems.
Yeah, they truly have a very special role. And I think yesterday you quoted Chit Ranawat where he says, your eyes only see what you know.
Exactly.
And therefore, as surgeons, we have very, very different approaches to some of these patients with chronic problems compared to the non-operative surgeons.
Yes.
Let's move on to research. You've been a worldwide leader in developing sort of treatment algorithms and an innovator in the use of sort of simulation and imaging modalities. You've published on very early use of ultrasound and CT to helping plan surgical treatment and the use of simulation. You were also involved in the growth arrest O'Brien's paper very early on, and then obviously on the involved in the ANCA study group. So tell me what drove you to be interested in research? I'm sure working at Harvard at the institution itself drives you towards that, but what drove you specifically to look at specific pathologies?
Well, I guess it was probably Professor Hall who instilled in me the drive to do even better. He was a brilliant surgeon, and he achieved things, particularly in the spine and in the hip, that others could only dream of. And yet he was never satisfied. He always felt that one could do better. He was always interested in principles. He was always interested in improvement. And he only died a couple of years ago at age 92, and he was still most interested in the newest of developments in his field. And so I think it was Professor Hall. And he encouraged us to do research, although he was primarily a clinician, as I think I am. Over time, we've been lucky enough to have some infrastructure to help us with clinically based research. Never enough, of course, but it was Professor Hall who encouraged us to improve. And you can only improve if you have good feedback, and I think the best feedback comes from clinical experience, but this is really not very sophisticated unless you really have good patient follow-up, good databases, such things. So I've been encouraged all along, and in Harvard have been lucky to be surrounded by teams that can bring much more sophistication to the process than I myself have.
Fantastic. Now, you have started to slow down in your clinical practice. Hope you don't mind me saying your age, which is, I know you're 76 years old.
Correct.
And as I mentioned, I also got to sit with Dr. Perry Schenica. Both of you remain to be so vitalized despite having such long careers. We would have long retired if it was in the UK. What continues you to push forward, carry on your involvement in education? Because I know you're continuously and continue to educate yourself. What drives you even at this stage?
There's so much more to be understood. And my recognition is, my admission is that at my age, fortunately surrounded by a group of outstanding younger surgeons and hippologists, if I may introduce that term into the discussion, I shouldn't be doing exactly what they do. You know, they've come to develop skills that equal mine and in many instances exceed my present skills. I can be proud of that. I can express wonder at that. But I'm driven to continue to contribute. And it's my hope that I can still have a perspective that lets me see things different from their perspective, and to continue to contribute in our understanding of these complex patients and their complex problems.
You've been talking recently about hippology.
Yes.
Tell me what you mean by hippology, and then we'll move on to the second part of that question.
From Professor Hall on, those of us in our group have, you know, we've been interested in caring for patients. I think that most or all in our group were driven to the practice of medicine by an interest to help people. It's rather trite and it's sort of an old phrase, but it's really true. In other words, we sort of were self-selected to care about the patients and their problems. And the bottom line is, I think that continues to drive us to help the patients. And so I think that's a lot of what continues to drive me, Pranay.
You also talk about hapology.
Yes. Yes. So let's get into it. So the science, again, to get back to the point, the hippology to me, it's lots of things. As I said in my talk, it's this whole field of investigation, if you will, collection of related interests in patients with hip problems. It's a set of philosophies. It is science to some degree. It's also a craft because, you know, we are orthopedic surgeons and we love to do surgery. But the surgery is really, it's only a mechanical thing if you don't understand the philosophies and the more distinctly human aspects that go along with the problems that we hope to improve with surgery. So, you know, hippology is a whole group of problems, study of patients with hip-related problems.
And you talk about patients, hippology, and yes. I know from the patient point of view, you're very much, you feel like you learn a lot from your patients still to this day.
Yes. Well, I mean, the truth is, that's the most interesting part of this. In other words, you're presented with a radiograph. At this symposium, a lot of our focused lecturing has evolved around images on the screen, images of hips. And the truth is, the image is a surrogate for so many other things, so many other dimensions. And the bottom line is, these hips all belong to patients. And you can have three hips that look very similar in three very different clinical situations. And so that's the probably the most interesting part of it all to me is the patient dimension, because the patients, each of them is different. I mean, there are patterns, but we continue to learn things about the differences of the problems that similar appearing anatomical situations and mechanical situations can present. Another aspect is, if you listen to the patient will tell you a lot of things that otherwise you would not know. You know, their perspectives are always different from ours. And if we miss what they feel the problems are, then we haven't really much chance in solving the patient's problems, which go way beyond just hip-related pain.
You've talked about how a specialty we've grown so much, especially over your career. Where do you feel the specialty is going to be in 20 years' time? Where do you hope it will be in 20 years' time?
Well, I expect that there will be a much more profound understanding of the interrelationships of the various fields of expertise that help us understand these, how to help better these patients with these hip-related problems. So that means that the psychologists will get a better understanding of what the surgeons see, and we can all minimize our blind spots. In slipped epiphysis, for example, you need two very good orthogonal radiographs, intraoperatively images, to make sure that those implants you're sticking in the femoral head are where they need to be and are not where they don't need to be. Well, it's similar putting the psychological perspective together with the mechanical perspective, the dynamic perspectives, along with the purely straightforward orthopedic cut here, do that perspective. So I think the field will have much more advanced computer power and abilities to integrate all our different disciplines into really helping in a much better way than we can today the patients with hip-related problems.
Let's talk about hapology, and I know this is something that you've been reflecting on as you look back on your career, about physician wellness and patient wellness. What would you advise to your junior colleagues and people coming into the field now, and how have you maintained a reasonable work-life balance?
I'm probably not the greatest example of work-life balance, whatever that is. I would say, you know my slides about red zones and green zones and how we really want the hips to be in a happy green zone where they can, there's homeostasis. Well, you know, my life has been rather chaotic. I don't know how any of us plan our lives. Certainly I didn't plan mine. But, you know, hapology to me is my made-up word of the study and practice of satisfaction and balance in life. And it's, you know, for me, a lot of my balances and imbalances have come in studying patients with hip-related problems. So I was very privileged to be the presidential guest lecturer at POSNA a couple of years ago. And Rick Schwend, a dear friend who asked me to give this lecture, has always been interested in balance and well-being of patients and physicians. And so as I reflected on what I should discuss, it was this relationship in my life of hip, the study of the hip and hip patients, with the happiness that could come along with it. And POSNA was the third leg of that lecture, how hipology, hapology, and Pediatric Orthopedic Society of North America have interacted in my life. And I think that these collaborations are very important in any of us achieving happiness and balance in our lives. And I know, Prana, you feel the same way, and this is another of my major themes here in Bern, is the collaborations that are so important. And it's easy to imagine that I should collaborate with my physiatrists and the radiologists and the biomechanics experts. It's not so traditional to consider ourselves as collaborating strongly with our patients in a way to push things forward, but that's an important aspect of the whole mix.
I love asking guests about books that they have read and their recommendations, because I can buy them and read them and I learn a lot from them. And I know that, again, your shelves are full. So tell me of a few books that you would recommend that all physicians should read right now to understand our current situation and maybe where we're going in the future.
Well, thank you, Pranay. I mean, I think that books traditionally have been a great way to one aspect of learning, at least. I still read real books. I do.
As do I.
My wife would laugh because I purchase books, And I look at the front page, and I will plow through a few pages, and a select few, I will get all the way through. I did mention a few interesting books in my guest lecture yesterday. One very important one is called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in Behavioral Economics a number of years ago. This is very important, I think, in our hurried life these days, because we are all programmed by our environment to think very quickly, to make decisions very quickly. As surgeons, as I said in my lecture, we tend not to be the greatest listeners. We will listen acutely for a very short period of time. Our attention will then drift back to what the image showed, and we will make a decision about what should be done for that patient, hopefully, for most surgeons, involving a surgical procedure. That's that. That's thinking fast. That's not thinking slow. And we often get into major problems in complex situations if we think fast when we should be thinking slow. So I recommend that book highly as not the easiest book to get through in a big hurry, but once you've read it, you will not regret it a bit. A very, very important book. Another very interesting, very short book, and I don't want to get into politics, but driven by a woman who lives in New York and is a producer for National Public Radio in the U.S. It's called The Trouble with Reality. And it gets back to people's comfort zones, what they see as the truth being, and the fact is that we don't like to recognize that there are things outside our own particular environment that we don't understand at all, and to try to understand them better would be uncomfortable, although in the long run it would be better. So those are two books that I've read recently that I highly recommend to your listeners.
Well, look, Dr. Millis, you know, I know you've described Professor Hall had a welcoming attitude to visitors and fellows from around the world. So I want to take this opportunity to thank you for offering me the same courtesy when I visited you last year. And you truly are his disciple, embodying what he was known for, which is compassion, respect, and excellence. And I really hope the audience has enjoyed listening to you. And thank you for everything you've done for the specialty.
My pleasure, Pranay. I look forward to collaborating more with you.
Fantastic. Thank you.